This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. In the week when in the Sky Bet Championship, Bristol City parted company with manager Dean Holden. Four consecutive wins when the season got underway was the club's best start since the 1927-28 season. He lost his last five, including a 6-0 thrashing at Watford, their worst defeat for over a decade. In Sky Bet League One, the best possible news, the Shrewsbury Town manager Steve Cotterill has been released from hospital after 33 days being treated for COVID. And in Sky Bet League 2, 10 of last Saturday's games and 18 of the EFL's 33 3pm kickoffs were postponed due to frozen pitches. It's the official EFL podcast. He might not thank me for introducing him like this, but we are on rather a nice streak of talking to Sky Bet Championship veteran players on the official EFL podcast over the past few weeks. Nottingham Forest Glenn Murray a fortnight ago, Watford's Ben Foster last week, and Preston North End's Paul Gallagher is with us this time around. When you look at your career, has it whizzed past, Gally?
Yeah, it's only now when you get to this age you start reflecting and looking back. I was going through my garage not long ago, and my youngest is seven, my son, and I was showing him some of the medals that I've won. And you forget what you win sometimes, and just going back and looking through, and you think, where's that time gone? From a under-17s Premier League winners' medal at Blackburn in the youth team to, you know, winning in the playoffs at Wembley. So, you know, I think it's nearly 20 years I've been playing, and as you say, it goes that quick. You have to enjoy it while you can. But even now, as an experienced player, you know, I'm telling the younger players, just enjoy it, work as hard as you can, dedicate everything you can to football, because it'll be over in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit like life. I think one sort of well-known, mainly Championship manager, describes life as two dates and a mad dash in between. And obviously a football career is only a sort of short span of that, isn't it? Did you reach a point where you realised you were coming down the other side, Paul, where maybe you've reached the peak of your physicality and things were starting to come down the other way?
I think it'll only probably be about now, because I've played regularly, you know, so my body's felt fine. Yeah. It's when you don't play on a regular basis and you're in and out of the team, or you won't play for 6-7 weeks and you come back in and you're trying to keep up with the young lads. You know, I'm still fit, but in terms of match fitness, I always think as an experienced player, an older player, you need to keep playing. You need the momentum with you. You need to keep in the rhythm, keep your fitness, match fitness. I know a lot of managers are quiet or will look after you, give you a rest. Sometimes you need that, but sometimes you just need to continue playing and training. And to be honest, I think I've trained every day. I've never, ever missed any length of time just by saying, oh, I need a rest this week. I'm out there training. If I've had conversations with a manager who said, I'll give you a rest this week, I want to train. Because you need to keep your body going, you need to keep everything functioning, and I just enjoy training as well, you know, learning other things. Even though you're 36, you're still learning, you know what I mean? And you've got aspirations to go into coaching, you want to see how things run and how things work, so that's something that I'm interested to as well.
Yeah, and still got the energy to go in your garage on your day off and start rummaging through unquantifiable cardboard boxes and thinking, what's at the bottom of there? I can't believe you've not got a giant, big, self-tribute, Alan Partridge-style sort of cabinet or something like that. Are you not bothered about that kind of stuff, to actually not remember what you'd won and things and just have them in a box in the garage?
Yeah, what you play football for is to win stuff. Even if you're a young player, grassroots, you play football to enjoy and win. And when I look back now in my career, I do think I won a few things there. I'm actually, you know, as you're going through your career, you kind of just, you're playing game in, game out, and just concentrating on the next game. You don't really get time to reflect and think, what have I won? Oh yeah, I've won a few promotions. I've won certain individual awards, player of the years. And so it was a real good way to show my son, like, this is what I played football for. Not the cars or whatever other people play, it's to win medals and trophies. And, you know, like I said, I've been fortunate enough to do that.
I wonder what the key sort of characteristic personal values have been that allows you to maintain a near 20-year career. I mean, we are talking your 19th season since you took your bow for Blackburn in the Premier League. What do you think has underpinned all that along the way?
Just hunger, desire, where I came from, my parents did have a lot of money, but money was never the issue. I just wanted somewhere to get out and try and better myself, my family, and that drove me on. You know, I played with players at Blackburn in the youth team, under-16s, 15s, whose parents were turning up in Range Rovers, dropping them off. I had to try and find a way to training. Sometimes I'd run there to training to get there. So I had that inner hunger to go as far as I could. And, you know, when I got the opportunity, I weren't going to let it go. And, you know, I've seen a lot of good players not make it, but just because they haven't had that hunger or that discipline to carry themselves forward.
And I was intrigued as well about, you know, we always imagine that football managers manage you as players, but you must have worked under so many different types of personalities across your period in the game. I mean, you must have just about seen every sort of person type, haven't you? From Tony Pulis at Stoke to Sven-Göran Eriksson at Leicester City and every shade in between.
Yeah, even going back to my debut at Blackburn, Graham Souness, you know, some character he is as well. And you see him now doing pundit on Sky, and he's excellent. And I'm always forever grateful for him for giving me the opportunity. But he was a manager that took no prisoners. No matter who you are, what you'd want, or where you come from, if you didn't perform in training or in games, he wasn't scared to drop you. And we had some real big players in that dressing room, the likes of Andy Cole, Dwight York, people like that. And as a young lad coming through, you find yourself in that environment and you either sink or swim. And, you know, fortunately for me, I managed to do really well. And, yeah, some of the managers, Mark Hughes came in after that, Sam Allardyce, played for Johan Boskamp at Stoke, Paul Sturrock at Plymouth, Nigel Pearson bought me, Paolo Sosa came into Leicester, who'd gone on to manage Fiorentina, and I think he's at Poland now, the national team. So, yeah, all different cultures and nationalities, but, yeah, you have to try and find a way to get in the team, and everyone's got different ideas how they want to play. And as a player, you kind of have to adapt to find yourself in the team.
Yeah, a couple of incidents from your career as well, and actually one name you haven't mentioned, Bertie Vokes. You were one of those players that got a Scotland cap under Bertie Vokes.
Yeah, I had, to be fair, I was in the under-21s with Rainer Bonhoff, another World Cup winner with Germany, and he was excellent, his training and the way he spoke, the way he conducted himself. I really enjoyed playing under Rainer. And to be honest, when I got the call up to the first team with Bertie, I was playing regular in the Premier League up front for Blackburn. I remember making my debut at Wales, and he said, just go on and do what you've done at your club. And he put me on right wing back. I was like, well, they're right wing back. I thought, you're watching the right Paul Gallagher here. So I've gone on right wing back against Ryan Giggs. I'm thinking, yeah, cheers.
Wow.
Never to be seen again after that, no wonder.
Well, I don't think Bertie survived much longer. That was a period when, very famously, I think he gave Robbie Stockdale a 5 Scotland caps because his uncle played the bagpipes on Paul McCartney's Mull of Kintyre, genuinely. And the only thing I wanted to ask you about as well was when he had to go in goal a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, I loved that. As a young player, we had Vince O'Keefe at Blackburn. He was a goalie coach in the youth team. And he used to do Thursday nights with the under-16s. This is when I lived at Brocco full-time as a YTS. And I go down on Thursday nights and join in, big goalkeeping, serving, have a go in the goals and flying around. I always went in goals for my Sunday league team if the keeper was ever injured. So I had no issues going in goals at Ipswich. I was absolutely delighted. Yeah. I was like, yeah, he should be sent off. The keeper should be sent off so I could go in goals. So that game, I came on as a sub. I scored a free kick with my first touch. Then my second touch was taking a goal kick with a goalkeeper gloves on, so it was incredible. But I remember as Chris Maxwell got sent off, the manager called a few players over, and I was one of the first over because I was, yeah, I'll go in goals, no problem. But I think he wanted to put Louis Malt in and leave me in midfield because I just scored. He thought, your confidence is up, you know the midfielders. And he said, go and speak to Louis, explain, blah, blah, blah. And I went to Louis and I just said, listen, I'm in net, you're staying out, end of. So I've gone back to Alex and said, you don't want to go in net, I'll go in net. So that was it. I kept a clean sheet, so.
Wow. I mean, that's a proper claim to fame. Make sure you tell your son that. Listen, when you look at that, at your whole career, and obviously if you look at the loans before you went to Preston permanently, it's sort of almost four different spells, isn't it? You might see them as connected through, but in terms of contracts and stuff like that, would you say Preston is kind of your club out of all those?
Yeah, I've said that clearly You know, I've been here 8.5 years now, whether permanent player or loan player. And when you come to a club and you play a lot, it means a lot to you. You have that affiliation with the supporters, the players, the staff. You earn their trust and respect because of how you perform on the pitch. But don't get me wrong, I had some great times at Blackburn. Probably should have played a bit more at Blackburn, but you always get labelled with a young player at Blackburn. Even though I was 22, 23, 24 when I left, I always felt it was the easy option to leave me out if he'd come through the youth team, he's still a young lad, which I didn't really like because I was a man now. I was 20, 22. I'd been out on loan, played a number of games. So I took that opportunity to leave. But like I said, I had some real good times at Blackburn. Going to Leicester was a fantastic club as well. I really enjoyed my time at Leicester under the managers that I had there. Some great players we had there for a championship level. But Preston is probably the club that I would say, yeah, that's the one that's closer to my heart. And like you say, when you get voted in the team of the decade, player of the decade, you know, you must have done something right. So, this club means a lot to me, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think enough fuss has been made of the club as well, that they're the only remaining club that have played every single Football League or EFL season, which you must feel a huge sense of history, you know, back through Sir Tom Finney, back all the way back to the very first Invincibles, that you're part of this long, long legacy, Paul.
Yeah, it's incredible. No, I actually went to Sir Tom. I've met him a few times. I went to his funeral, and the respect of that man is incredible. When people say Preston North End, he's the first man that comes to your lips is Tom Finney and what he did for the community of Preston as well, the city. I think he worked as a plumber and he played as well. So, and he just stayed at Preston all his career, didn't he? And represented England, and yeah, phenomenal. But like you say, I think we played our 5,000th game this season, I think it was, in the league. So yeah, that was nice to be a part of that as well. So yeah, this club's steeped in history, and some of the players that have come along the way have been excellent for this football club as well.
I mean, big time of transition for the club. As one of the old guard, with that level of change, how do you preserve the culture that has carried the club to this particular point?
Well, I think the manager, in his recruitment, he goes for the right characters, the right people that will come into the club and not disrupt the changing room. They'll come in and fit in perfectly. And we've always had that. I've always said this has been a real family club, and the changing room has always been together. And when he does his recruitment, he looks into people's backgrounds, where they've come from and how they've been brought up, really, through other clubs. And for instance, Ben White has come through at Man United. I know he'd gone to Sheffield United after that, and obviously Doncaster. But he had a good background of a good schooling at Manchester United and Sheffield. So he does his homework like that. And as you say, you know straight away when a person walks in the change room how they're going to carry themselves and act. And you know, we've got players in that change room who would say something if it needed to be said. And luckily enough, we haven't have to. So, you know, like you said, we've brought in the right players. But like you did say, we're going through a big change. I think the players prior to this January had been together for 4 or 5 years playing together. Mm-hmm. And now we are, like, to bring 8 players into a team that they've played is difficult, and it needs time to gel. But what we have got is a manager that will get the best out of them. And you can see with players who have moved on, you know, he's not moved them on to, well, only this January, but before that, he moved Callum Robinson to the Premier League, Jordan Hugo to the Premier League, Ben Davies goes to Liverpool. So he's always improved them into a level where they're going higher.
I don't think people fully understand as well. You mentioned Ben Davies there, that he was due to be out of contract in the summer, because I think people might look at that fee and think, oh, that's not very much. But actually, if he was to be sold on again by Liverpool, it would be for a much, much higher fee. This is a player with a hell of a lot of talent, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah, incredible. I see Ben, because I've been here that long, I've seen Ben coming through the youth team and coming to the first team. He had to go out on loan a few times to earn his stripes, and when he come back, he's been excellent. You know, if you can get a left-footed centre-back who's quick, can read the game, comfortable on the ball. And I had a few people texting me, Stephen Warnock, who played for Liverpool, David Thompson played for Liverpool, asking about him. And I said, if he signed a new contract at Preston, you would have to pay $20 million to get him out, because he's that good. And I just hope Liverpool give him the opportunity to play, because I think if they see him playing, they'll think, oh, we've got a gem on our hand here. And Preston probably didn't want to lose him. They probably thought he was going to go somewhere else, but like you say, he would have gone for nothing. So for us to get a bit of money, and if there's a sell on after this, we get a bit more money, it makes sense really, because I think if Ben ever comes back to the Championship, I hope he doesn't, I hope he goes on and plays at Liverpool for many years, but I'm sure a Championship team will have to pay a fair whack for him to get him there.
Elsewhere in the Sky Bet Championship, Brentford's magnificent 21 match unbeaten run was ended by Barnsley. One of Barnsley's own, Mick McCarthy's best ever start to a new management job continued with Cardiff City. They made it four consecutive wins and six matches unbeaten under the twice former Ireland boss, and Derby County's gradual rise under Wayne Rooney continued. It's now five wins in six. Your fixtures this coming weekend: on Friday night, Watford entertain Derby. Then at 12:30 Saturday lunchtime, Brentford travel to Coventry. Norwich entertain Rotherham. Reading entertain Middlesbrough. There's a bit of a relegation skirmish in Sheffield Wednesday against Birmingham. And Paul's Preston have the, well, what looks on paper like a rather tough challenge of going to the Cardiff City Stadium. What does the future hold for you, Paul? What are your plans? Where are you heading with your life? What are you doing next?
Hopefully go to NFL and be a kicker, I think.
That would work. That would work for you. You've got the power in your shot.
Well, they can go out there and do it till they're 45, can't they? If you see Tom Brady, the way he plays quarterback. But no, the last few years I've done the under-16s at Preston, so I've really enjoyed that. You know, I've done my coaching badges, so the manager gave me the opportunity to work in the youth team with the under-16s, and I've done that for the last 18 months, and I've really enjoyed that. And this year I've been more involved with the first team, going into meetings, watching how the manager works. And I tell you, the manager works so hard. The amount of stuff he goes through, the analysis, breaking the team down, giving our team the best opportunity, the knowledge of what's coming ahead. So it's been really good to see it from that perspective. And I think when you get older as a player, you kind of play like a coach. You know, when you're a young player, you just focus on yourself. I need to do this. But when you get older, you start helping other people around the pitch because you kind of see things happening quicker. So I've enjoyed that role as a player. But yeah, going forward, I would like to stay in football and try and give something back. I feel I've got a lot to give back to football, and hopefully at Preston North End. And like I said, I've enjoyed this year. Obviously, I want to play a little bit more, but you kind of understand when you're getting older, your time might be limited. And going into that side of coaching is something that I'm really interested in.
Fantastic to talk to you. Listen, go back and have a rummage through those boxes in the garage. You never know what you might find. There'll be that Sandy you bought in 2004 with your first Blackburn bonus payment. You know, could be a nice tin of paint so you can touch up the shed when the good weather comes and things like that. And a bit more football memorabilia. Great to talk to you, Paul.
No worries. Thank you very much for your time.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
February is LGBT plus History Month, something we're proud to support here on the Official EFL podcast as part of the campaign to promote equality and diversity in the game. And as part of the league's no tolerance approach to discrimination in any form, in August 2017, Ryan Atkin came out as the first openly gay professional match official in England, and over the years has officiated in both the EFL and the National League. And I was going to ask you a really obvious question, which would have been along the lines of why the only high-profile person in football to come out as gay. But then actually, I thought to myself, what I really kind of want to know first is, did you accept the fact in making your decision, Ryan, that you were going to become a figurehead? You were going to become a key point of contact for discussions like this?
Ultimately, it was a decision that I wanted to make myself, based on my sort of authenticity and how I bring my whole self to the game. And I know a lot of athletes will talk about, you know, when you're not your authentic self and when you're not who you want to be, you know, that 1 or 2% can make a big difference in your performance, both mentally and physically. And I suppose it was there on the back burner that being the first would mean that, you know, I would be invited onto a lot of interviews and podcasts like this, and discuss and represent the sort of the community that currently exists within the football game.
I mean, I would even go so far as to say, and this is no slur on your refereeing, but I would have thought you will struggle to overshadow this as the peg to talk to you with your refereeing. Please don't think I'm being in any way derogatory your refereeing, because you get enough pelters, you lot, at the best of times. But do you understand what I'm saying? It's going to follow you around forever, and therefore your decision was based on being genuine, but actually there was a whole load of self-sacrifice in there as well, it seems to me, from the outside.
Yeah, I took a lot away from sort of Nigel Owens, who, you know, I'm fortunate to know and to see his experiences in life. And, you know, we grew up in different times. You know, he was from a small village in Wales where, you know, completely different generation. I'm lucky, you know, 1980s born, living in Plymouth, moving to London, which is very cosmopolitan. So my life experience has been completely different to Nigel, but actually within our sporting professions, it's been very similar. And being able to be open and honest and be myself has certainly improved my own sort of happiness, but also my game, you know, and how I apply myself to football. And I think the more that people do that, and the more that people are accepting that we are all different, and it's not just about the protected characteristics, which I know people get very upset about when they say don't bring politics into football. You know, it's not about politics, it's about looking left and right and noticing that everyone is different and that we should just accept those differences. And sport is a great way of bringing so many different people together on the basis that they have a passion for the beautiful game. And that's sometimes lost when you see derogatory comments and on social media, some of the comments that are made by people who say they love football.
But the very fact that you found the freedom to make your decision and had that light bulb moment of wanting to be genuine, to be that comfortable in your own skin, does that obviously doesn't make the abuse and discrimination right, but does it help you to override it and kind of dismiss it like I would if somebody contacted me on social media and said you're the worst reporter I've ever encountered or the standard criticism? I mean, does it make you comfortable repelling that you are totally genuine now?
Yes, ultimately, yes, it does. And I think, you know, one of the things that I remember Nigel talking about was how, you know, you can't be something if you can't see it. You know, and there are a lot of LGBTQ plus individuals who go to football, participate in football, are in football in the professional game, who, you know, unfortunately can't be or don't feel comfortable enough to be themselves and be the role models. And actually, if we look at the last year, you know, we've had some fantastic movements by players themselves around Black Lives Matter, around, you know, feeding families. And, you know, you just have to look at the abuse that they've received online because of their race or because of what they're doing. But ultimately, I hope they would do the same as me and sort of just, like as you said, bat it away. And for me, they're insignificant people, because that is not what football is about. And certainly the image of the game doesn't want those people to necessarily be involved in the game. So I think it's really encouraging to see players starting to take up the mantle, using their position for good.
Do you think coming out has in any way impeded your professional progress? I'm sure that the refereeing bodies are all very supportive, and I'm sure you've got lots of great colleagues, but do you think there has been an effect on your professional progress as a match official?
Personally, no. And I would hope to think that there's no negative discrimination, but also when I came out, you know, and I made sure that it was well known that I didn't want positive discrimination. I'm to be treated the same as everybody else. I'm a referee. I'm not a gay referee. I'm a match official. I'm a referee who happens to be gay. And actually, I should be rated on my performance on the field of play as a referee, not because of my sexuality. And, you know, that was made very clear to me by the footballing bodies, and something that I made clear to them, because nobody wants a token gesture. We want the best to rise through the game, and no different to players. You want the best to be picked from the academy teams to play for the first team clubs, you know, with the basis of you know, of winning the league or winning the championship or winning the Premier League, and that's what we want. And that's what we want within the refereeing sort of family. You know, we want the best to rise to the top and to reach those heights and to one day represent, you know, the United Kingdom when it comes to FIFA tournaments and UEFA tournaments.
Ryan, I am going to ask you the obvious question now, which is, why do you think, what are the drivers that make you the only openly gay man in elite professional football in England at the moment? What is holding a player from coming forward at this stage? What are the key things?
I think ultimately, within football, we thought we had a good grasp on racism. But actually, it's been lying dormant. And it's been there. And with the advances in social media, and probably with COVID, and the fact that people are watching football through streaming channels, social media channels, the temptation to type behind a keyboard or a screen, and for their emotion to come through, which, you know, can be very derogatory, discriminatory, offensive, abusive, comes through. But ultimately, we thought that, you know, we had a good grasp and a handle on racism. And what we see is actually we haven't, and we didn't. And it's starting to bubble, and it's starting to bubble over now. And there's a lot of work being done in the game when it comes to racism. And with racism, it's visible. You know, a majority of the time, you can identify somebody potentially based on the colour of their skin. However, with LGBTQ plus, it's not like they're running around with a rainbow or, you know, a light bulb flashing above their head. It could be anybody. And as I said earlier, without visibility, you don't have people who are growing up saying, well, I'm a good footballer, but I may happen to be gay, bi, transgender. I can do that because I see somebody like that operating at the elite level, etc. And I think ultimately, if you don't create the right environment, you don't create somewhere where somebody's going to take that leap of faith. And it is that leap of faith, because ultimately I do believe that for the first footballer to come out, not only will they receive so much support, but they will receive support from the media. I do believe they will receive support from potential sponsors. You know, and what will be great is someone else actually being able to, especially within the playing region, be able to take on that mantle. You know, I'm a football referee. I'm there to attend a football game, arbitrate between two teams, give hopefully a fair decision, because somebody's got to make the decision between, you know, between two teams. Nobody wants to make it, but, you know, that's our role. And to disappear quietly after the game. You know, I'm not there to be on billboards. I'm not there to be banging the drum. But when it comes to LGBTQ plus in football, then I have to be, you know, and I try to separate that between my refereeing role and my role within sport to try and drive the change that's needed. And if we're not going to create the environment and we're not going to tackle homophobia and racism head on with clear policies, clear objectives and a clear stance, how are we ever going to solve the issue? And if we haven't solved the issue with racism in 2021, how far are we behind with things like homophobia and LGBTQ plus players coming forward? So ultimately, more has to be done. And it's not about a rainbow flag, even though that's great visibility. It's about key individuals within the game supporting everyone and ensuring that actually what they say is what they believe, that actually football is welcoming of everyone. And as long as you've got the talent to officiate or to play in the top football, then that's all it should be based on. There should be no stigmas.
Ryan, can I just ever so slightly switch tack? I know you follow the media because I saw you'd retweeted, I think, Football Focus's Stonewall FC video that was put online by BBC Online. Ex-player Thomas Beattie is a former youth team player, first UK-born male professional footballer to come out since Justin Fashanu in 1990. Just a couple of quotes that really caught my eye. He said, most people aren't coming out now because we're still trying to redefine what masculinity is, and that's a big issue in sport. And he actually goes on to say, football is very physical, robust, aggressive, so any attack on your masculinity feels like it's a dig on your ability to perform. I know some of the most feminine straight guys and some of the most masculine gay guys, and it has no bearing on your ability to perform as a footballer or do anything else. So the clear implication there is that if somebody comes out, their manager is going to think they're not up to the battle on a wet, freezing Tuesday night at Brunton Park.
Yeah, that, and you know, Thomas sums it up quite nicely. Actually, there is a big thing about masculinity. But actually, if I think back to adverts when it came to challenging what masculinity was, and I remember the early adverts with, I think it was Gillette and other products around facial cream and, you know, what I would call, you know, things that pamper men. It was footballers that were leading these campaigns. And ultimately, you know, when we see football, you know, we see, especially within, you know, high profile games, they turn up, you know, they've got their wash bags, they've got all, you know, they've got the latest stuff and they look good. And that's because they take care of themselves. And so ultimately, you know, you've got to question what is masculinity, what is toxic masculinity, and how does that impact on somebody's ability to play football? And I think the views and opinions of how a man should be have slowly changed over the last sort of 20, 30, 40 years. And that's only because society is changing, professions are changing, you know, and actually we're becoming equal. You know, if we go back so many years where women didn't have the right to vote, they couldn't do the same things as men could do, we're now in a position where actually we're all starting to become equal. And you don't need that masculinity, because what does masculinity do? What does it prove to anybody apart from yourself? And that's, you know, he makes a fantastic point that there's probably education to be done in that for managers that believe that somebody who is LGBTQ plus doesn't want to run out on a Saturday when it's pouring with rain, because it's actually probably the opposite. And I know that if you go around the country where there are many LGBTQ plus football leagues and rugby leagues, they're the first out of the changing rooms playing a game of rugby or a game of football on the local parks, where the facilities aren't great, you know, certainly the pitches aren't great. So if they can do it on the grassroots, then we can do it in the professional game.
Ryan, if there was somebody out there that's going through the same sort of dilemmas that you were in early 2017, before you came out, thinking about it, thinking about what the consequences would be, thinking about the changes it could bring to their life, what would your advice be to them?
My advice would be to look inside yourself and decide where you want to be and where you want to move forward. Have a good support network around you, because friends and family, and even those that you work with, will be your greatest allies and your greatest support. And I'm very fortunate. My story was very positive, and it is very positive. Others haven't been so lucky, especially during lockdown. You know, we've seen examples where, you know, for some young people who are having to move back home where their parents don't accept their sexuality, it's a very, very difficult position to be in. And that's why it's so important that, you know, we have that support network around us. But ultimately, you've got to remember everything will be okay in the end. And living a life in the shadows is not living a life. And you've got to decide for your own health, for your own mental health, when is enough. And I would hate to think that there are players who are not able to share the spoils of their success in football with their partner because the fear of coming out or the fear of sharing their, you know, their existence and their joy in their sport. And we don't have that problem in the Women's Super League. I'm very fortunate to referee in the Women's Super League, and it's such a fantastic league. And we have openly out, you know, LGBTQ plus players. And so we've got to look at that and look to see if we can replicate it. Because ultimately, the greatest joy and the greatest life experiences I have had has been since coming out and to be my authentic self. And there will be negative impacts. Yes, you'll have negative comments on social media, but those people are insignificant when you think about your close friends, your family, your profession. And that would be my greatest advice to somebody that's thinking or contemplating coming out.
I have huge admiration for somebody who is clearly so comfortable in their own skin. Thanks for sharing your story. I feel like I'm not treating you as I normally would a referee, because we managed to get through the whole thing without giving you pelters for some of your dodgy decisions.
I get enough of that already, so...
Okay, I'll let you off then. Thanks for joining us on the official EFL podcast.
No, thank you, Mark.
This is the official EFL podcast.
In Skybet League One, are Oxford United the ones to watch as we head into the final third of the season? Last year's beaten playoff finalists are just outside the current top six. Over the next month and a bit, they play all the clubs around them, and they are the EFL's current form team. Over their past 10 games, Carl Robinson's men have nearly tripled their points tally. And I'll come to that in a minute, Carl, but when was the last time you searched yourself on Google? Be honest with me.
I don't think I have.
You have. You must have.
The last time I did it, right, was probably the club asked me, they said, Carl, when's your 500th game? And I said, how'd you find that out? And they said, if you can go on to this site, that site, and that's the first time. Do you know what, Clement, the reason why I've probably not done it since is, I've got some, there's pictures on there saying I'm a James Corden lookalike, which my daughter agrees with. And there's a lot of other very peculiar sorts of things, that pictures of myself pulling silly faces. So, all the criticism you get and the positivity you get, you have to take it as, at the same level. So if I don't listen to the positive things, I don't really need to listen to the negative things either. So that was the last time, probably just before I did 500 games. So, whenever that was.
Okay. Well, listen, I mean, it's a loaded question because somebody has got the website address of Carl Robinson. It's either Carl Robinson, same spelling as you, .com or .co.uk. And they are purveyors of handmade medieval Tudor and Stuart leatherwork.
And that's me, but I'll be honest with you, mate. I'm finding management a bit boring at the moment. So I've tried to sort of branch out and look at other unique ways of earning some money if I get bored of management.
Well, you've certainly found a unique way there, mate. I can't imagine the little workshop going on all around you as people fashion leather into medieval torture devices and Lord knows what. Actually, on a serious note, your missus has a business which you do get involved with a tiny little bit. She's doing a lot of work in the field of mental health.
Yeah, it's massive, mate, to me. When we got promoted, a very close friend of mine, Andy King, who QPR and Everton and Luton, was like a father to me within the industry, and he passed away, and I struggled for quite a while and not truly understanding what was actually going on. So the more and more I read into it, the more and more, and Richie Barker's brother Chris Barker sadly took his life, I think it was over 18 months ago now. Ever since then, it's been something that as a family, we're dedicated to try and let people understand that what mental health really is, because if mental health has got a stigma around it, people are frightened to talk about it, people are frightened to really understand it and dig deeper, delve deeper into it. And my wife, between the two, we've always had criticism with her background being an actress and obviously me being a football manager. So it's something as a family that we felt it was really, very important, and we do different talks, and we've got my wife's business got an app which helps companies. Funny enough, Bristol Rovers are trying in one of our apps at the moment to support all their staff, because prevention is massively important, and having people understand and being able to speak about it, it's going to only improve what people think of mental health, and more people will start to talk, which is the most important thing.
Yeah. I mean, are there benefits as well from stepping away from football's coalface? And just, does it give you slightly more subjectivity, and you realise how fortunate you are?
Yes. I don't think a day goes by, though, Clem, to be honest with myself, that I love the job that I do. I know I laugh and I joke about and I moan about it at times, but I think I'm quite lucky. I've been doing it for long enough now that I understand the highs and the lows of it. I think my daughter allows me to step away from it. She keeps me very real in her personal criticism towards me, and the relationship that we have is fantastic. So we're a very close-knit family. So I think I'm very, very lucky that I can step away at certain times. But my wife goes mad because every night I'll be watching a game somewhere, mate, but I still find that as enjoyment. So I do have a better awareness of my own self right now more than ever before.
I mean, over a decade at the age of 40 as a manager, you've already mentioned the number of games. How have you evolved, but which bits of the young buccaneering you, one of the youngest managers of all time, have you still kept?
My hair.
All right, don't rub it in. Thank you.
No, but for me, it's more a case of sort of, people keep saying, oh, I'm still young. And actually, in relevant terms for managerial purposes, at 40, it is relatively young. But I've been very, very lucky to be doing this long enough now to understand that it can all end tomorrow because of the harshness of the industry. But the one thing that I've probably kept more than anything is my enthusiasm for football. How much I love it, and I've never forgot that I'm still a football fan. I still support Liverpool, and I still sometimes, I think sometimes we forget that this is still the greatest game in the world, and we don't appreciate it sometimes enough, I don't think.
I mean, have you also played the long game with your choices of clubs? I mean, it was well publicised a few years ago that you were strongly connected with Leeds United, but it was under an owner at the time that was hiring and firing managers left, right and centre. So
yeah,
you...
and that was the one reason that why I never went. People might find that baffling to think, but after meetings that I had, it wasn't something that I was willing to do. There's been two or three other jobs of bigger clubs that I never felt ready, Clem. I always thought to myself, once you get 500 games under your belt, then you can look at it in a completely different light. But for me, I never look at my own personal sort of gain and where I can go next year or the year after, because I think first and foremost, if you start losing games of football like we did last night, you could soon be forgotten about. But for me, my next step, if I had an opportunity, I'd love to really work abroad one day. That's always been a big sort of drive in me, probably from about 4 or 5 years ago. Just the ability to learn a new culture, to learn a new style and to educate myself more a little bit, I think.
Interesting.
I don't know when that'll be. That's not... I've got an extremely long contract still at Oxford United, and like I say, I'm still only 40 years of age. I could be 10, 15 years down the line, but I just think that it will be a great opportunity and something different for an English manager to challenge myself away from our game.
We're talking to you in the aftermath of the Papa John's Trophy defeat to Tranmere.
Yep.
Obviously, you've got the pain of missing out on another Wembley appearance. But listen, you've missed out in the playoffs as well 3 times over the course of your management career, including last season. How do you use the disappointments to create the highs that follow?
Really weirdly, I've been involved in 3 playoff campaigns as a manager, and weirdly I lost the first game. No, I won the first game against Peterborough and lost the second game. I lost the first game against Huddersfield and won the second game, and in this year's one I drew both. So in the 6 semi-finals I've won 2, drawn 2, and lost 2, and obviously the final being obviously a defeat to Wickham, which was in very extreme circumstances. I think the only thing it can do, it makes you aware of how hard defeat is to take. I think it makes you incredibly respectful of winning once you lose in big games. I think we forget that word of respect. I think winning, you have to respect winning and losing first before you can truly appreciate it. And I think for us in the summer, it was a difficult one, especially with the way the world is right now. And it was so hard for me, Clem, to come out and say how difficult I found it, because you're having people all around you who are sadly losing their lives through COVID-19 and the different restrictions that we're putting ourselves through. And it's just a little old football manager or big football manager in size sort of talking about how a defeat can hurt you when there's far more important things going on in the world right now.
Yeah. On that subject, if I might, we've got Steve Cotterill, thankfully, just coming out of hospital after over a month getting treatment for COVID. Kenny Jackett is taking some elective surgery on an issue that he's got. He's already missed one Portsmouth game. He's going to miss a few more. Do you think, finally, the penny has dropped with football managers that they need to come before the job? Because I do get the impression there was a real badge of honour of never missing a game for any reason whatsoever in the past. And maybe there's a greater realism now. And of course, in Steve's case, he wouldn't have been able to do it anyway, because A, he was positive, and B, he was debilitated.
Yeah, I think the LMA do a fantastic job to try and support us in a number of different aspects of our managerial careers. I think, especially from our own physical health, and I know the support over recent years as well, the LMA are investing an awful lot of money into the mental health side of our game as well. I think in a weird way, and you never want this to be the case, it humanises what we do as people. I think people see us as sort of on a touchline for 90 minutes on a Saturday and Tuesday and think we're there to be shot at and things that go on. We're just normal people that do a job that people sometimes can criticise you for and praise you for weirdly within a 90-minute period. So I think, especially with Steve at the moment, obviously seeing what he's going through or listening to what he's been going through and how the football club of Shrewsbury Town stuck by him and supported him, and thankfully now I'm being out of hospital, I think it was only yesterday. I dropped Kenny a text the other day, obviously delving into what's going on. It's not for me to want to know or for anybody to know. That's his own personal side of his life that if it comes out, he will speak about it, but if he doesn't want to, he won't. And all of our thoughts within the football world go with him. And we play them on Tuesday, and obviously we had the playoffs with them last season as well. So he's a man that I've got amazing respect for, somebody that's stood the test of time at a number of different football clubs and been incredibly successful as well. So we just wish him well, and hopefully he comes through this period.
Elsewhere in Sky Bet League One over the past week, Sunderland's Charlie Wykes got all four as his team beat in-form Doncaster Rovers. Bristol Rovers parted company with Paul Tisdale less than 3 months after he arrived and Northampton Town with Keith Curl and Burton Albion's revival under Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank continued with a win at Northampton after two of those in their first 22 league matches. They've now managed three in four. Your fixtures this coming weekend: there's a rather tasty derby battle between one of Carl's former teams, MK Dons and Northampton. Those two seem to play each other every week. I don't know if it's me that just thinks that. Lincoln are away at Wigan. Peterborough entertain Wimbledon. It's Portsmouth against Blackpool. Doncaster Hull, two of the top six, go head to head. And Carl's team, Oxford United, are at Ipswich. Fifth season in League One. Do you think you are benefiting from a gradual acclimatisation and not being part of this boom-bust culture where fans, having had one promotion, just expect another one straight away?
Yeah, I think when you look at Oxford United, I think when you look at the size of the teams that you just named some of them within our league, we're not in the same size as them in the financial sort of spending aspect of it, but we certainly foresee ourselves as being very capable of coping with these teams and pushing them all the way. You just mentioned there about Paul Tisdale started losing his job against Bristol Rovers. We were the team that played them on the Tuesday before he sadly lost his job on the Wednesday. And you know what, Clement, it really hammers home this job, because the first half, the first 15 minutes, we were very good. And for the next hour, Bristol Rovers were by far the better team in the game and missed a number of different chances. And the game could have been oh so different if an element of luck was on the side of Oxford United that night. And then all of a sudden we score a goal in, I think, 93rd minute, and you find out a manager the next morning losing his job. And you think, it just shows you that you are sometimes at the mercy of an element of luck. But going back to what you said about our club moving forward, we do foresee ourselves in a big, big month going forward. Obviously, Ipswich, I think it's Portsmouth, and we've got Peterborough and the likes of Hull and MK Dons to play over the next few weeks. It's going to be a really busy few weeks.
Yeah, it is.
It's great though, Clem, because this is what the EFL is all about, the level of competition, how fair it is, and how we've sort of embraced the current sort of climate that we're trying to perform within. And I think all the footballers and all the managers and the football clubs and the chairmen as well, they sometimes deserve to sort of step back and take a bit of a sort of, not a round of applause, but just to keep the game going in these difficult times, just to give people a little bit of hope and a little bit of normality in some ways through their difficult times. I think the EFL and the Premier League, to be fair, have stood up and tried to make it as good a competition as possible.
Great to talk to you. Just while I've got you, have you got a pen and paper there, mate? Can I give you an order? I'd like a sheath for my sword, a shield, please. And do you do quivers for arrows as well?
Do you know what, though, mate? I'd love to see you in all this.
I'll tell you what. If you win promotion this season, I will have a picture taken with a nice leather shield with my sword in hand and its sheath hanging down my side and a little sort of quiver of arrows hanging over my back. Is that a deal, mate?
Do you know what, mate? That could be the final piece of the jigsaw that we need to try and get that motivation to get promoted.
Great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us in the official EFL podcast.
Cheers, mate. Take care.
On to Skybet League 2, where Daryl Clark has swapped managing Walsall for Port Vale. A point for Southend United at leaders Cambridge United last weekend lifted them out of the bottom two. And a midweek win for Salford City over Barrow lifted them to within 3 points of an automatic promotion place. Your fixtures this coming weekend. Early kickoff on Saturday. Exeter entertain Grimsby. Cheltenham entertain Bradford. Cambridge are at Mansfield. Newport against Forest Green Rovers is fifth against second. Salford entertain Carlisle United with 3-5 games in hand on the teams above them, depending on who they are. And Tranmere entertain Oldham. That's it for another episode. A huge thank you to Carl Robinson, Ryan Atkin and Paul Gallagher. If you've enjoyed it, then please give us a 5-star rating. Press the subscribe button and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. I'm Mark Clement. Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.